Xu Yonghai was imprisoned in China because he was working for the legalization of house churches, So this might not seem like a really big deal to us, but it was a serious deal there and was certainly very dangerous. So not only was he imprisoned, but actually he was sentenced to be executed. And so he's in his cell. It's this 4x4 cell, which is very small, and he's got a bar of soap for cleanliness. That's all he has. And so he spends his time praying, obviously. He spends his time reflecting on scriptures. And he also sort of, something comes to his mind. It's an outline for a book about the greatness of God. This outline for a book on the greatness of God. So he has got this outline, and the only thing he has, he doesn't have a pen or a pencil. He has this bar of soap, and so he etches out the outline to this book, and then because he's got time, he memorizes it, because he never knows what will happen to him. Now, praise be to God, he was released, so that's amazing. So he goes home, and eventually after a time of rest, because he had memorized the outline to this book, he writes it down, and his book ends up being called God the Creator. It's about the greatness of God. Now, it is very, very easy for us today as modern Christians here in the West, in our highly individualized society, in our civilized society, when we think about the kinds of things that God is doing in our lives, to look at all the stuff that's going on around us, or maybe even the stuff that God is doing for us, and kind of not really paying attention to what he is doing in us. We look at all the stuff that is happening around us, and it's easy to neglect the stuff that is going on inside of us, even though quite often it is the stuff that God is doing in us that may actually be a part of his most significant work in our lives. Xu Yonghai didn't have very nice things happening around him, right? And if you had asked his family, hey, God is great, and so he believes, so what is God doing for him? And I bet his family, if you were to ask them that question, they wouldn't have had a lot of very positive things to say, and yet God was doing incredible things in him. Now, today we continue our series on the book of Daniel, and so far we've been going through a lot of the great and famous stories of Daniel, right? The writing on the wall, the fiery furnace, Daniel being rescued by the grace of God from the lion's den. And starting last week, we transitioned into a new part of the book where we're dealing with four big visions by Daniel about the end of days. And so what we're going to do is I'm going to actually provide a little bit of a summary of what we talked about last week as we move into today's text, because the passages are related. And in fact, what we're dealing with today in chapter 8 builds on chapter 7. And so here's kind of a graphic that summarizes some of what we talked about. So as part of Daniel's first vision, he saw four beasts rise out of the sea. And a beast that looked like a lion with wings emerged, and it represented the Babylonian Empire of Daniel's time. Second was a beast that looked like a bear with three ribs in its mouth, and that represented the Medo-Persian Empire. Third was a beast that looked like a leopard, also with wings, but this time with four heads, and this represented Greece. And then finally, a beast was unlike the others, and it was even more terrifying. It had horns on its head, and this represented the king and kingdom of Rome. So today in chapters 8, we're going to continue with a similar theme, although the imagery is going to slightly change. And instead of talking about four kingdoms, this vision really zeroes in on kingdoms 2 and 3. And so whereas before it was a bear and before it was a leopard, now that imagery is going to change. The Medo-Persian Empire is going to be represented by a ram, and the Greek Empire is going to be represented by a male goat. And it's not just a guesswork that that's what it represents. Later in the chapter, we will actually be told specifically that that's the kingdoms that they represent. Now, before jumping in, one other detail we need to look at is something about a leader historically who was particularly horrific, and he features prominently in today's passage. And so at the tail end of the Greek Empire, a particularly brutal ruler emerged. His name was Antiochus IV. He wasn't supposed to be ruler, but he had gathered these people around him. He seized the throne by force. And he had coins minted with his own likeness on them. Here's the coins. These have been preserved historically and archaeologically for us. And so on the left, he is depicted in the likeness of Zeus, the Greek god. And on the other side of the coin, it's a bit smaller, but there he is again like Zeus, and he's holding the Greek goddess of victory, Nike. So that's where it comes from, the shoes. It's the Greek goddess of victory. But you can't really read it here, but there's also a script there, and it says God manifest. And so he calls himself God manifest, okay? So he sends out a decree, and this, by the way, is the second century before Jesus, sends out a decree that people should worship him like a god. We've heard that before, haven't we? But of course, many people go along with it, but there's a group of people particularly who do not want to do this because they only worship the true God, the Lord, and this is the Jews, the Hebrews. And so Antiochus is really upset by this. It throws him into a rage. He goes in, he wages this massive attack on the people of God and upon the Jerusalem temple. Jerusalem becomes a literal bloodbath, okay? So he goes in there, he basically outlaws the laws of Moses, he stops worship in the temple, and he actually rededicates it to a pagan god, Zeus, the one that he has made in his own likeness. Okay, so we need to know that about Antiochus the IV, because we're going to hear more about it. Now, having provided that background, and just as we move into the text, I want to provide us a reminder of three final things, and here they are. First of all, when we deal with passages like this, we are talking about big and difficult things, my friends. And that is good. That's what we want to be doing. There are big things happening in the text, big things happening in our own world today, and we need to do this. And we can. We are adults, okay? So if I come up here and quote a few cute little Bible passages for you and tell you a few cute stories that make you feel nice for 30 minutes, I'm not helping you to live in this world, to be robust disciples of Jesus in this age in which we live. That's the first thing that needs to be said. Second, these passages deal in symbolism. So there's a lot of symbolism going on. We need to do some work with our brains as adults to try to figure out what means what. Okay, an animal represents a kingdom, and how does that symbolism work, and what else is going on, right? We should love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. And so we are leveraging some of those muscles in passages like this. And also we need to acknowledge that when you get into serious and sometimes complicated passages like the ones we are dealing in the second half of Daniel, there are multiple layers of meanings. And so, okay, sometimes an animal represents a kingdom and there's a historic ruler. And yes, that happened in the past, but there's something about him which serves as an archetype for an antichrist figure in the future. We are looking at Daniel and what's going on around him, but also inside of him. So we just need to be aware that there are multiple layers of things happening at once. And so I invite us to think not only about these massive global events historically and maybe even today, we're also thinking about what's going on inside of us. What's happening inside of Daniel? What might be instructive to us as he endures the hardships that he is dealing with? So, with that introduction, let's look at the text, Daniel 8, beginning at verse 1. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first. Okay, so this is now the third year of Belshazzar, so Daniel's now 69. Verse 2. And I saw in the vision, and when I saw, I was in Susa the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision, and I was at the Ulai Canal. I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher one came up last. I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him, and there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. So in the first part of the vision, by the way, he's not necessarily in Susa, but that's where the vision takes place, which is 380 kilometers to the east, and he sees this ram with horns, and as we know, and as we will be told specifically later, this represents the Medo-Persian Empire, which comes right after Babylon of Daniel's own day. Verse 5. As I was considering, behold, a male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he ran at him with his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. And the ram had no power to stand before him. He cast him down to the ground and trampled on him. And there was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. Then the goat became exceedingly great. But when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And instead of it, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. So after having seen the ram, there is now this male goat, more literally a he-goat, and comes, and this represents the Greek Empire, as we will be told and explained shortly. So he's going so fast, which probably indicates the quick rise and power of the Greeks under Alexander the Great. It looks like he's not even touching the ground. Now, it has this big horn, and this horn represents the ruler, which historically we know as Alexander the Great. But it then says that the horn is broken, and that surely refers to Alexander's death. He dies, and then four horns come up behind. And so this is most likely a reference to the four generals of Alexander the Great who started to rule the kingdom after his own death. Verse 9. Out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. It grew great even to the host of heaven, and some of the host and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. It became great as the prince of the host. Okay, so a new horn emerges, and this represents the rise of who we talked about earlier. This is the Seleucid king, Antiochus the IV, right? And so this is the man who severely persecuted the Jews. He waged war on people. He horrifically desecrated the temple in Jerusalem. Now, it says that also he was exceedingly great toward, quote, the glorious land. And so this is most likely him facing Judah in Jerusalem, and then the very temple that he would desecrate. Now, it says that he became even as great as the prince of the host. Now, this might be a reference to God himself because he is so arrogant and obnoxious, he considers himself God manifest, as we heard on the coins. It may be a reference to the high priest in the temple, hard to be sure. Continuing. And the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of his sanctuary was overthrown, and a host will be given over to it together with the regular burnt offering because of transgression, and it will throw truth to the ground, and it will act and prosper. Okay, so there's a lot of things happening, so we're doing some of the work to figure out what's going on. It talks about a regular burnt offering being taken away. Well, because he desecrated the temple, he outlawed proper worship. This means that the regular sacrifices in the temple were taken away, right? And so that period of worship ends. The reference to a host being given over, the word host often means army. So the idea is that even God's army is not able to overcome what Antiochus the IV is doing to them. And truth is being thrown to the ground. Verse 13. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, "For how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and host to be trampled underfoot?" Verse 14. And he said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state." Okay, so here we have two holy ones talking. So we assume that these are two angels having a conversation with one another. And they're talking about how long this will occur, this desecration in the temple. And we are given a time frame, 2,300 mornings and evenings. Now, if morning and evening here refer to one unit, that means this is 2,300 days. If those are to be enumerated separately, it would mean 1,150 days. The point is that it will come to an end. Verse 15, "When I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it. And behold, there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, and he called, 'Gabriel, make this man understand the vision.' So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, 'Understand, O son of man, that the vision is for the time of the end.'" Okay, so here's something really unique and rare happens, okay? So here we have an appearance by the archangel Gabriel. And so the archangel is a reference to the fact that he is very high ranking as an angel. So the world of angels and demons, there's a lot of structure. There's a very specific hierarchy that exists. And in the Bible, only two angels, we're only told two angels' names. One is Gabriel and one is Michael. And Gabriel is mostly a messenger. Michael is more of a warrior, and some really interesting things happen with Michael the archangel in chapter 10. So we're going to get there shortly, and I'm really looking forward to that. But Gabriel is mostly a messenger, and here he appears. Now, a couple of things about angels before we move on. First of all, you just need to expunge from your mind the Hallmark depiction of angels as pudgy little Cupids, okay? It's not realistic. We need to be thinking more large, majestic, powerful, brilliant, so much so that when you encounter them, like Daniel, who you're falling your face in reverence or shock. This is a picture of Gabriel by Gustave Doré, the artist. It's a bit dark. It's hard to see. He's around. There's people all over on the ground around him. But even this depiction of Gabriel is too small. It's not quite dreadsome enough, not quite brilliant, majestic enough, okay? But a couple of things about angels and demons, okay? So there's good spirits and bad spirits. So bad spirits we tend to call demons or unclean spirits. They're disembodied and they're disloyal to God. So they've rebelled against God, and fundamentally they seek deception and destruction against the people of God. We are made in the image of God, the one against whom they have rebelled. And if we belong to Jesus, we remind them of Christ, the one who has ultimately triumphed over them on the cross, and their days are numbered. So we are particularly hated. Now here on this other side, there are good spirits. These are angels. Now angel is a general term. It means messenger. They serve a variety of functions, but they are good and they serve God. Now they're also ancient. Now think about it. So here's Gabriel. So this is the 6th century before Christ, and here's Gabriel, okay? Now when else do we see Gabriel? Well, roughly 500 years later in the New Testament, in Luke 1, he comes. And he actually says to Mary that she's going to give birth to the Messiah, to Jesus. That is a long, they are ancient beings. Gabriel and Michael, they're still around today doing things, so they are ancient. We think of the unclean spirits in the demonic realm. Well, you know, they've been studying you and your family for generations. They know how to get us. Like, they're very smart. And so, same thing with good spirits who are angels. So they've been around a long time, right? And so Gabriel here, he comes on the scene, and when he comes near, Daniel is so terrified, he falls on his face, right? Because he's this powerful, majestic being. Now, nevertheless, he snaps him to attention and says, okay, pay attention. And he says what he's about to share with him is about the end of time itself. Now, quite often, there's these multiple layers of meanings, right, in apocalyptic language. And so he's probably referring to the end of Antiochus IV, but some of the things he says can be applied to the end of time in a more general sense. Verse 18. And when he had spoken to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and made me stand up. He said, behold, I make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the indignation. For it refers to the appointed time of the end. As for the ram that you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. And the goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn between his eyes is the first king. As for the horn that was broken in place of which four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. So recall also that this is hundreds of years before these historic events actually take place. So this is a prophetic word for Daniel. Now, as Gabriel starts to speak, Daniel strangely falls asleep. He's probably so overwhelmed that his senses actually check out and he just collapses to the ground. Nevertheless, the archangel grabs him, snaps him to attention, and explains some of the stuff that we've already explained. Verse 23. And at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit, a king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise. His power shall be great, but not by his own power. And he shall cause fearful destruction and shall succeed in what he does and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints, meaning the people of God. By his cunning, he shall make deceit prosper under his hand, and in his own mind, he shall become great. Without warning, he shall destroy many, and he shall even rise up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken, but by no human hand. The vision of the evenings and the mornings that has been told is true, but seal up the vision, for it refers to many days from now. So then the archangel Gabriel explores more about the king with great power, referring to, as we've discussed, Antiochus IV. And all the things he says actually check out historically, right? Let's check them out. He will destroy people. Check. He will destroy many of God's people. Check. He did that. He will be cunning, right? Remember, he wasn't really the true and rightful first heir to the throne. He gathered people in a bloody revolt. Check. He shall be great in his own mind. Check. Remember the coins? He called himself God manifest. All of those things come to pass. And then Gabriel goes on to explain that Antiochus will rise up against the prince of princes. Does that mean he's rising up in rebellion against God himself? Well, surely that is true. It probably is also a reference to the high priest in the temple. And then Daniel, after all, is told to seal up the vision, meaning that he should keep it safe for future generations. So he's going to preserve it, right? But the things that have just been described to Daniel won't come to fulfillment for 380 years. Okay, 380 years. He's got to hold on to this, and this is going to be a word of hope for the people, but long into the future. So imagine you're here in 2026, and you've seen these visions of kingdoms and pain that will come upon you and upon people in the world for generations upon generations. Oh, and by the way, it won't come to an end. It won't come to fulfillment until the year 2413. That's the same time horizon that Daniel is dealing with. Verse 27, and I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for some days. Then I rose and went about the king's business, but I was appalled by the vision and did not understand. Okay, so we're told that Daniel's so overwhelmed, he falls physically sick for several days. But eventually he rallies himself and he goes back to serving in the king's court. He serves King Belshazzar. But now in his mind, he knows that the ram is coming. And after that, the goat is coming. Disaster is on the horizon. This is the word of the Lord. Okay, so what might this have meant to Daniel and his contemporaries? Well, I think in some ways it means a similar thing to what it meant last week. And we said, okay, if Daniel and his contemporaries are going through all this hardship, surely it would have been a word of hope to them that even though they're going through hardship now, and even though they're dealing with difficulty, and even though it seems like God isn't really doing much, he actually is. There's pieces of a plan coming together. Hope will win out in the end, and God will rescue and restore his people. But for us today, today's focus is not just on the big picture of what was happening around Daniel, but today we are focusing on what's happening in Daniel. Okay, we're looking at his experience. The last verse in last week's chapter says this, as for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me and my color changed and I kept the matter in my heart. So clearly he's exceedingly distressed last week. And then this week at the end of chapter 8, this is what we find. I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for some days. Then I rose and went about the king's business, but I was appalled by the vision and did not understand it again. And so Daniel is clearly distressed a second time. And it makes sense. Think of all that Daniel has been through, because I'm inviting us as we go throughout this series to put ourselves in his shoes. As a reminder, as a teenager, he was taken captive to serve in a foreign land. His home was most likely burned. Many of his family members and friends killed. He was most likely castrated and taken to serve in a foreign court. He was made to serve in that court of his oppressors for nearly 70 years of his life. And then he has visions from God that oppressive kingdoms will continue. In fact, the current kingdom that was oppressing him would give way to another bad kingdom that would give way to an even worse bad kingdom, the ruler of which would engage in abominations and desolations in the temple. And then, because of chapter 7, we know that an even worse, more horrific kingdom would come. Relief would occur after 500 years, but even then there would be trouble. Friends, how did Daniel manage? How did Daniel manage? Here's how. He focused not only on what was going on around him, but inside of him. Christian writer and therapist John Eldridge says this. Next slide. The war for the human heart is the epicenter of the war in the world. Okay. The war for the human heart is the epicenter in the war for the world. And so what we're going to do is take a moment to look at some of the things we are specifically told about Daniel in terms of what is going on inside of him that gave him that strength and capacity to endure. First, Daniel was a man of consistent prayer. We are told this specifically. He is winning within. We are told in Daniel chapter 6, verse 10, that his custom was to pray three times a day. Morning, noon, and night. Morning, noon, and night. The day after that, morning, noon, and night. The week after that, morning, noon, and night. The month after that, morning, noon, and night. The year after that, morning, noon, and night. The decade after that, morning, noon, and night. The decade after that, morning, noon, and night. And so if the war for the human heart is the epicenter in the war for the world, Daniel was winning that war in prayer. Second, Daniel was a man of learning and of wisdom. They could not take what was going on inside of his mind, and he cultivated that for not only his own good, but for the good of his people. He had a reputation for wisdom. We learn this even outside of the Bible, outside of Daniel, even in passages like Ezekiel 28:3. He used his wisdom for his own benefit, to serve kings, to change laws that preserve the life of his people, also to seal up scrolls of hopeful visions for the future. And so if the war for the heart is the epicenter, actually, in the war for the world, Daniel was winning the war in his mind. Third, Daniel was a man who kept going. Think back to all those things that Daniel had endured time and time again, decade after decade after decade. Did he give up? No, he didn't give up. He just kept going. He kept persevering. Even with this latest vision, it makes him sick. It's so appalling. And yet at the same time, after a couple of days, he gets up. He keeps serving the king. He keeps going. And so if the war for the human heart is the epicenter of the war for the world, Daniel was winning that war through his resolve to never give up. Fourth, Daniel was trustworthy. In fact, he had a reputation for being trustworthy. His enemies, specifically in chapter 6, verse 4, called him trustworthy. And so the kingdoms around him might be horrific and evil, but he chose to remain faithful and true. This is about his character. The people around him, even some of the people from among his own kind, would have surely been losing hope in their God. Really, God, are you supposed to be great? And yet Daniel chose to remain faithful and true. And so if the war for the human heart is the epicenter of the war in the world, Daniel was winning the war by remaining faithful and true, even when others weren't. In his day, think about how big and powerful and foreboding all those kingdoms must have been. That was the big talk, right? Babylon, Medo-Persia, and then Greece, and then Rome. But we today, we have to do work to even remember who they were. What did they did? Who were the rulers? We need to check multiple sources to figure it out. But who do we remember? Daniel. Focus not only on what God is doing around you, but in you. Friends, focus not only on what God is doing around you, but in you. Win the war in prayer. Win the war in your mind. Win the war through the resolve to never give up. Win the war by remaining faithful and true. We started by talking about Xu Yang Hai. Xu Yang Hai won the war within, influenced the war without through a cell in China. Daniel won the war within, influenced the world without through serving in a foreign court in Babylon. And you can win the war within and influence the war without right here, right now. Focus not only on what God is doing around you, but in you. It may be one of his greatest works in your life. Amen.